Chapter 18. Shadowy Figures and a Strange Experience. The Sangha Trust was a rather shadowy body. Or perhaps I should say, the members of the Trust were rather shadowy figures. The only one I could be said actually to know was Maurice Walsh, with whom I had been in correspondence previous to my return to England. Indeed, it was Maurice who, on the Trust's behalf, had invited me to spend a few months at the Hampstead Buddhist Vihara. Whether he was at that time its chairman, I do not know. He was certainly chairman at least from the early days of my incumbency. He was also chairman of the Sangha Association, and in this double capacity was often to be seen at the Vihara, especially when there was an organisational crisis, at which time he would rush round from his home in a panic and generally succeed in making matters worse. We're told Stepien, an amiable but excitable Pole, was treasurer of the Trust. He was a friend of Ratanasara and a supporter of the latter's plans for a London Buddhist college. And it was he who, without consulting his fellow trustees, had allowed the ambitious Sinhalese monk not only to invite his old friend Dhammaloka to teach Pali at the college, but to promise him that the Trust would meet all his travel expenses, provide him with board and lodging, and pay him a handsome salary. Stepien's loyalty was to the London Buddhist College rather than to the Sangha Trust, and I knew him much less well than I knew Maurice even, especially as he took little part in the activities of the Vihara and was seen there only occasionally, usually in the company of Ratanasara. The most shadowy figure among the trustees was Marcus, so shadowy that I cannot recall his first name. Marcus was a solicitor. Though not a Buddhist or even interested in Buddhism, he had been brought into the Trust in his professional capacity and was its longest-serving member. He was seen at the Vihara very briefly, only on the rare occasions when the Trust met, and I could not have spoken to him more than once or twice. But though two of the three current trustees were such shadowy figures, the Trust itself was not really a shadowy body, in that it was a registered charity and controlled by statutory requirements and limitations. It was the Trust that owned the Vihara and the house next door, as well as Biddulph Old Hall, and it therefore was the Trust that, in point of fact, allowed the Sangha Association, and latterly the London Buddhist College, to use the Vihara premises for its activities, and that invited monks to come and stay there. It was the Trust, too, that appointed the resident caretaker of the house next door, the rents from which constituted the Trust's only regular source of income. The caretaker, Bernie Whitelaw, was a lean, hyperactive man in his late 30s, with a thin, haggard face, grey-blue eyes, and an expression that was both startled and worried. He lived with his cats in the next-door basement, all the other flats in the building, with the exception of the one occupied by Dhammaloka, being let furnished to short-term tenants of various nationalities and varying degrees of rectitude. Besides the actual caretaking, Bernie had the unenviable task of advertising vacancies, interviewing prospective tenants, keeping existing tenants happy, collecting rents, and making sure nobody fell into arrears or did a moonlight flit. It was also his duty to come and see me every Saturday morning and give me, out of the rent money, the £15 the Trust allotted me each week for the housekeeping and other expenses of the Vihara. I had no personal allowance from them. On such occasions, Bernie liked to stay for a little chat, and as he was a talkative soul, I learnt quite a lot about the idiosyncrasies of his tenants, the trouble they gave him with their unreasonable demands, their squabbles, and their reluctance, in some cases, to pay their rent on time. I also learned a lot about the previous occupants of the Vihara. Monks and novices, like the tenants who were their next-door neighbours, had come and gone over the years, but Bernie and his cats, in their snug basement abode, had remained a permanent fixture, and as his confidence in me increased, he expressed himself about them and their predecessors at the old Sangha house in Swiss Cottage, more and more freely. From all this, I gathered that Burney did not have a very high opinion of the trustees, either past or present, nor view with unmixed approval what had been going on at the Vihara previous to my arrival on the scene. Though he was loyal to the trust in his caretaking capacity and served it conscientiously, his real connections were with the Buddhist Society rather than with the Vihara and the Sangha Association. He was an ardent admirer of Christmas Humphreys and a faithful member of his Zen class. His most fervent admiration, however, was reserved for the police, whose praises he sang even more frequently than he sang those of the Society's lawyer president. "They've got this fantastic loyalty," he would exclaim, his eyes shining. It did not surprise me that Burney's best friend was a policeman. Gordon was a large, slow-moving, blonde young man, who, since he lived with his wife in a distant suburb, sometimes stayed overnight with Burney after attending the Zen class, of which he too was a regular member. Lest there should be any misunderstanding on my part, Burney was at pains to assure me that although he and Gordon shared the same bed on such occasions, their friendship was a platonic one. Whether Toby was aware of his acolyte's enthusiasm for the force, or what he would have thought of the way Burney distributed his praises, I do not know. I do, however, remember an incident which, though slight, may not have been without significance. Toby was paying me a visit, and we were standing by the window of my room talking. On happening to look out, we saw a black police car draw up outside the house next door, and three or four uniformed officers get out and go inside. I knew the officers were friends of Burney's, probably dropping in for a cup of tea and a chat, but Toby's eyes narrowed, and he watched the car for some time, apparently in order to satisfy himself that there was nothing wrong. What Burney had told me about the Sangha Trust, particularly its failure to submit returns to the charity commissioners, disturbed me. I therefore spoke about the matter to Morris, who had already been made uneasy by the extent to which Stepien, under Ratanasara's influence, had in effect been siphoning funds belonging to the Trust into the London Buddhist College, partly as a result of my intervention, and partly due to tensions within the Trust itself. There was a showdown, the upshot of which was that Stepien resigned as a trustee and George Goulstone was elected in his place. There was also talk of inviting Alf Vile to join the Trust, and both he and Mike Hookham, in fact, did join it some months later. So far as I remember, I had not heard of Goulstone before. He certainly had not been attending lectures or classes at the Vihara, even though he lived only a few hundred yards up the road. Like Marcus, he was a solicitor, and Morris, who seems to have known him socially, may well have invited him to join the Trust in his professional capacity. Unlike Marcus, he was a Buddhist of sorts. At least he had installed an image of the Buddha in the garden of his weekend cottage, so I was told, and was sponsoring a young Tibetan refugee, an incarnate lama, who had recently arrived in Oxford. I never had the opportunity of verifying the first report, but a few weeks after his joining the Trust, Goulstone, a short, middle-aged man who sported an imperial and dressed in black, invited me to accompany him and his wife to Oxford to meet the new Rinpoche, whom they would be seeing for the first time themselves. We reached the towery city by midday, after a pleasant drive, collected the Rinpoche and took him to the Randolph Hotel for lunch. Throughout the meal, Mrs. Goulstone, a tall, handsome woman I had not met before, was very gay and lively, even flirtatious, and I could not help wondering what the Rinpoche, who seemed a decent, serious young man, thought of her behaviour. As he knew Hindi, we were able to have a good discussion, and I presented him with a set of Tibetan monastic robes I had brought with me from Kalimpong and never used. From the hotel, we returned him to the flat where he was living with two other incarnate lamas, Trungpa and Akong, both of whom were already known to me. Trungpa and I had met in India not long after his arrival there in 1959 as a refugee. He was only 19 then and did not know a word of English. Since that time, He had acquired a reasonably good command of the language, and I had invited him to speak at the Vihara's Wesak celebrations. The day I accompanied the Goulstones to Oxford, it was very hot. It had been hot all that week, and it was getting hotter. And the fact served to remind me of what Mr. Van Buren, the acupuncturist, had said back in February about my needing treatment for my heart and about summer being the best time for treating that organ. In mid-July, I therefore went to him for the big prick, as he called it. There, in fact, were two pricks, one in the little finger of my right hand and the other in my right wrist. The instant he gave me them, there surged up my arm and from the depths of my trunk a current of energy which, hitting the brain, knocked me right out of the body. I found myself located, as it seemed, 15 or 20 feet above my own head, a little to the right. I felt quite unperturbed, as though what had happened was the most natural thing in the world. Moreover, even though I was out of the body, I still had a body that was in all respects identical with my ordinary physical body. Presumably this was the Manomaya Kaya, or man-made body of Buddhist tradition. Looking down with the eyes of this body, I could see Van Buren frantically massaging my legs. When I came to, my heart was beating faster than usual. I felt slightly sick, and I was bathed in perspiration. I also had a feeling of physical well-being, such as I had never experienced before, a feeling that lasted several days. Before I left him, Van Buren told me that for 30 or 35 minutes I had been technically dead. With this statement, I was not in a position to either agree or disagree, since while looking down at myself, so to speak, I had no awareness of the passage of time. So far as I was concerned, the experience could have lasted 2 minutes or it could have lasted 2 hours. Years later, medical friends assured me that Van Buren was mistaken in thinking I had actually been dead. At the time of death, they might well be an out-of-the-body experience, they pointed out, but it did not follow from this that an out-of-the-body experience was an experience of death. Whatever the truth of the matter, the experience I had in Van Buren's consulting room that hot July afternoon in 1965 was certainly one of the strangest in my life. After the acupuncture, I went to a tea shop with the friend who had accompanied me and sat drinking tea outside in the sunshine, feeling like one new risen from the dead. From the tea shop, we walked to Oxford Circus, and from Oxford Circus through Soho to the Charing Cross Road, where I bought a copy of P.W. Martin's Experiment in Depth, a Jungian work popular at the time, and where my friend left me. Having looked in a new Chinese shop and bought a small porcelain figure of Kuan Yin for my mother, whom I would be visiting the following month, I made my way to Cambridge Circus and so up St. Martin's Lane to Monmouth Street. Here I found a shop selling Japanese arts and crafts, and on going inside found that the proprietor, a cheerful man of about 40 with big bulging eyes, had been attending my lectures at the Vihara. The name of the place was Sakura, and in years to come, the obscure little Japanese shop, or rather its basement, was to play an important part in my life and in the history of British Buddhism.